Hello, welcome back to Railway Mania. I'm joined once again by Pat James, who was our guest in episode 3 of Railway Mania. Pat, welcome back to the show.
Hi.
This week we're going to be talking about 009, the smaller brother to 00 gauge. Everyone knows 00, it's the scale that Hornby trains come in. Pat, if you can just give us an overview of what 009 is to anyone who's not heard of it before.
So 009 is a 4mm scale, 1 in 76, which is used by Hornby with 00 gauge. But instead of using the 16.5 gauge track that Hornby use, is using N-gauge track, which is 9mm gauge, and that scales down to representing 2 foot 3 gauge track. So it would be the same in 4mm scale as the Talith Lynn and the Corris and some of the other historic narrow gauge railways.
Right, but in a lot of modelling circles, 009 is treated as kind of an elastic gauge.
It was either 1 foot 11, which a lot of people represent Festiniog using the 9mm gauge track. Anything up to 2 foot 6, I suppose. Obviously, when you're moving towards 3 foot, you'd be looking at TT gauge, which is 12mm gauge track.
My first guest on this episode is prolific narrow gauge modeller Daniel Thomas and his dad Mike. Daniel's going to chat about not only his own modelling, but also the history of 009. After that, Pat and I will return with some more tips, tricks, musings on the future on this most enjoyable of gauges. Daniel, welcome to the podcast. Mike, welcome too.
Hello, everyone. This is Dan.
This is a show mainly about 009 modelling.
Yes.
Could you start off by telling us a bit about yourself and how you got into the hobby?
So basically, I'm 20 years old and an illustration student who studies at the University of South Wales in Cardiff. And I'm from Neath, South Wales. It all began at the age of 2 when my mum bought myself a Marks & Spencer's own brand wooden train set. After building a sizable collection, my dad finally thought it would be worth me to move up a gear.
We ended up, one Christmas, we decided to actually get a proper board. So we bought some track, took the track out of the set, and I got a piece of MDF from work, painted it green, put the track down, and then Christmas morning came around. We gave him the Virgin train set, and he opened the box up and said, "Where's the track?" So I said, "Well, there's a sheet over there, but you need to pull that sheet over." So we pulled the sheet off, and there was this double track loop with a couple of sidings on it, all just there, waiting to go, right? And but the funny thing was that he was so fixed on getting the Virgin train set, he didn't even notice this big sheet over the table in the middle of the living room.
Yeah, it was the best Christmas present ever, and I loved it. So after a couple of years, I mostly became more aware of industrial railways, like especially with where I'm from, you know, South Wales, there are a lot of collieries. I really liked the whole industrial thing. It was just something so unique and, you know, engines working hard and pulling loads of wagons all around. It was at that point when I started to be edging more towards 009.
So what was the introduction to narrow gauge for you?
I think I just saw a Wikipedia page on it. Like, I just came across a Wikipedia page and I thought, oh, this is interesting. And then I started reading up more about it and I was just really fascinated by it. It was just really such an interesting scale that I'd never heard of before. Prior to, you know, when I discovered it in 2014, all I knew was 00. And so I started off by basically buying an item on Rolling Stock, one of the newly released Pico and L&D vans. And so from then on, I thought about building an engine. I decided to do what in 009 terms is a very common thing, and that is pug bashing. And so I essentially made this saddle tank tender type thing. Like, I literally just took the body of the pug, gave it some trans skirts to disguise the N-gauge loader, and scratched built a tender to go with it. Like the Stiniog George England locos. It was really the first thing properly I've ever made successfully somewhat in my life.
So there wasn't much in the way of ready-to-run 009 at the time?
Well, it was only just starting to sort of come out, especially in 2014, because the thaw then, if you wanted really anything ready-to-run 009, you had to kind of adapt any of the HOE or HON30 ready-to-run stuff from the likes of Rocco, Lilliput, and more recently, Mini Trains. But obviously, there's like loads of kits out there, like especially from manufacturers such as Dundas Noddles, Langley, Gem, yeah, and Backwards Miniatures, and of course, Tico, which all sort of began in the 60s and 70s when there was a slight rising interest in narrow gauge modelling caused by the introduction of N-gauge in the 1960s. Narrow gauge modelling itself isn't very new. It's been something that's been around since at least the early 20th century. But it wasn't until one guy came along in the 1950s and 60s that really, really totalized it. His name was T.D. Hancock of Craig and Lurtenford Railway fame. He built this railway on 9mm gauge track.
So that's N-gauge track.
Well, back then, no. It was generally referred as triple O because N-gauge was a more recent term adopted in the early 60s.
So then you would have had O, double O and triple O.
Yeah. Triple O was namely popularised by a kind of such as Lone Star, which had those push-along models. Before then, it really, N-gauge, well, it wasn't really around. The only thing I had closest to it was 2mm line scale.
Which... Was that because they were restricted by the size of the motors and mechanisms that they could build?
Yeah, it was. Generally, back in those days, you were very much restricted by the size of motors. Even before the war, double-gauge models had issues getting motors inside them, which is why we adopt double O, out of the consequence of the time where motors were just too big to fit in the British prototypes. So this guy, P.D. Hancock, he had a railway called the Craig and Lurtenford, set in an imaginary place in Scotland called Craigshire. So from humble beginnings, he built like a massive narrow-gauge system with engines that were either scratch-built or had adaptions from items available at the time, such as one of them had a body that was from the die-cast toy from a company called Noco, which became Lesney and then became Matchbox.
So he was adapting things that he could buy as toys at the time into scale models.
Yeah, essentially. Another prominent one he had was when he took some poppers made by a company called Condon that were made for a set in Woolworths, regauged them from Double O. He had his own history and sort of came up with his own characters, which to this day I still find very enduring. The whole idea of not only creating a fictional line, but also having a fictional history to go with it, you know, with its own quirky characters and such.
And had many people been doing this before him, or were people mainly modelling from real life?
Other modellers previously had this whole idea of creating a world. Like, I think the most famous one is John Hearn on Nadder Valley thing. I actually managed to see it close up and personal, behind the glass.
Yes, we did. We paid a visit to Bendon, and luckily enough, we went there just as it opened, and it was. We chose the day especially because it was one of the very few days of the year they actually operate the Nadder Valley Railway, due to the sort of fragility of it.
Because it's so old?
Yes, because it's so old. So it's quite fragile, so they don't operate it very often. I think at the time there was about six times a year. We made sure we got there early. Well, I think at the time we were the only two people in the place. Next thing, when I looked around, I could see him. He was actually inside the glass of the Nadder Valley Railway, taking photographs with his phone of close-up of all the things. And it turned out that they'd seen him glued to the glass for about 3/4 hour.
Mm.
And then when they had a tea break, they asked him, would he like to come inside and actually take some photographs of the thing close-up, you know?
So that's lovely.
It was quite a surprise, actually. They were very, very good.
It's so nice when people can recognise enthusiasm like that and reward it.
Oh, yes, it is.
Dan, can you tell us about the 009 models that you've made since that first start?
There was one item that I needed, a gunpowder van, and I looked at some prototypes online, especially at the Talaflin Railway. I made my first scratch build, which I did back in 2015. It's really a red shed with a grey rooftop, and the body was done in plastic card. All the rivets were individually indented using brass strip. And the chassis itself, the Pico wagon, I took one of them, cut and shut it, and inverted it around. So it's kind of like a double cut and shut and glue kind of thing. I hand written the lettering on it using a drafting pen. It was really the first model I built that was successful and didn't end up looking terrible for once. I built the model and I showed it to the knights at the club and they were really impressed.
I didn't know it was a scratch build, I thought it was a kit build.
No, it was...
What was next?
From the gunpowder van, I built a bogey flat wagon to carry cable drums to the mines, built using a kit from the 009 Society of the R&AD flat wagon. Yeah, it was my first successful kit bash. And I suppose that is something, you know, if you want to try with modelling in general, I think there's a part of me that's like, I just want to strive, I want to do better, and I want to improve. Like, I just generally look at what other people have done or what techniques out there and thought, you know what? I'm going to try that.
But I think one of the saddest things is when people are paralysed by by fearing that they're going to fail. Do you know what I mean? So to actually take that step, knowing that it might not be up to the standard that you want it to be, but taking that step anyway, I think is quite important.
I do have the fear of failing in a way. I think we all do. You know, I've had cases of failure with models, the Thor, but I feel like that was a matter of just trying, really. I mean, it's something I experience in modelling and generally in my studies as an illustration student with, like, drawing, because it's a case of, you know, taking constructive criticism and improving it. Obviously, there's some things I have got with my railway that, retrospectively, I'm thinking, I could have done different, but have to live with the consequences, in a way.
So when you're building models, what materials do you prefer to work with?
I mean, the materials I generally use are plastic card, so like styrene sheeting and microstrip, wire, like lots of wire, like some brass or nickel silver wire. And
is that for like hand rail details and pipework?
Yeah, and the pipework I generally either use fuse wire or solder. Like solder's a really good, like especially the representing like the thicker pipes. And for some of the finer details, I tend to use a lot of like white metal castings, especially from like specialist suppliers such as RT Models and Gem. Like they do a great set of like locomotive chimneys, which I use on all our models. And I like to sort of create a uniform look. So some components are obviously quite similar on most of the engines now. There's like a sort of the house style. And yeah, I generally use a wide variety of materials to complete and finish models.
So I guess in a way it depends on the job you're trying to do.
Yeah, like for example, on the Troodos, basically there's some, what you can see, there's some fire iron holders and those were soldered. And the entire Thor that you see, that was soldered. I am planning one day to have a go at doing stuff completely soldered, like completely soldered, like loco or kit.
And would that be working with materials like brass?
Yeah, and I'm starting to work with brass sheet now. Like, I'm kind of adapting a Backlund Baldwin, and part of that is I'm constructing like a back CAD sheet, very much like you see on the prototype loco 590, which was at the Welsh Highland Railway, which had like a back sort of CAD thing, although that one was made from wood, whereas mine would be like a brass sort of sheet with a soldered on spectacles, which I plan to work on soon. Like I say, I like to try and use different methods whenever I could, and generally methods that I think would suit. Like, I think I'm still very much learning on how to do things, you know, and I think I've heard a lot of people say, you know, there's like soldering is a bit of the dark art, and yes, there's a knack to it, but you know, it's all about giving a go sometimes, and whenever I feel comfortable, I'm gonna have a go at soldering brass or white metal.
I think you're absolutely right in that it's that first step, it's taking that leap.
I think that's kind of been a bit of the trepidation, especially with, and even when you now there's some things and a little bit on, and generally have to have the assistance of dad every now and again, because like even though I've been doing it for 4 years, there's still stuff I need to learn, and obviously still need a holding hand, especially with people like my age building these sort of models at this sort of scale is not exactly what you call, like, there are no, I know that there are people who are people my age who do it, it's not exactly what you call a common thing in a way, so
yeah, absolutely.
You know, I still need sort of help with that.
Although I think if you look at your development arc over the past 4 years, as you say, if you continue on this trajectory, I think you'll be fine.
Exactly, yeah, I'll be great. You know, and that's another thing I would say is patience. There's no point rushing a model unless you have to, absolutely have to, but otherwise no. Sometimes when you rush models, they end up looking terrible, you know, and I've had that, and generally that's a piece of advice I would give to anyone who's looking to do this sort of stuff.
It's one of the common themes, but often one of the hardest ones to do when you're really excited about something.
Yeah, and I do get that a lot. Like, I sometimes, generally with a project, I generally get really excited and do it for a bit, and then lose interest and go back to do something else.
Do you find that you often have more than one project on the go at one time?
Yeah, pretty much. I've pretty much had that for about 3 years. So, I mean, I've still got stuff that I started like 3 years ago that I still haven't finished. Like, generally, even a lot, like most of my stuff is still very much unfinished, because I'm still finding stuff and I'm still doing things. You know, I start something, go on to something else, finish that finish it, now I've got back to that. And
it's almost like spinning plates.
And a bit like that, yeah. I end a bit like that, but I think at the same time, it can be a bit of a negative in a way, because again, you'll never really finish stuff. Like, generally, that's why things really taking so long. But again, you know, these sort of things, they tend to offer you the spectres. And back to what I was saying earlier, rushing models is not a good idea, in my view. And unless you're quick about it, which I'm not, like, I'm naturally quite a slow person, I like to take my time and generally not try not to mess up. And, you know, like I said, it's a hobby. I want to take it as long as I want with it.
Yeah, absolutely. It shouldn't become a chore.
No.
Should always be fun.
It should always be fun. And when it does become a chore, I'm just like, I want to do something else.
It does happen as well. You tend to get sidetracked. You'll start doing something, and then what you'll find is you think he's gone off and done something, and you'll come back and say, look, I've had this, and I think if I cut this, and this, I can make something else.
Inspiration strikes.
Yeah, it's one of these things. It's sort of something completely different happens, and then whatever he's working on gets put to one side, and he just goes and just thinks something up and makes it. I mean, these two models in front of us here, one is a horse, it's a dandy wagon containing a horse, which came about, I think, because you just thought it up one day,
yeah,
and you decided that you're gonna make it. And I think it was like a side project that just sort of happened.
Unlike that sometimes to projects is that I just see something and I'm just like, I'm doing it. Inspired by sort of the Stiniog's use of dandy wagons, especially the old wooden ones, I thought, I'm going to make one. And so with a darts castings horse at the top, so yeah, I decided to make an early style sort of dandy wagon, which actually dates from the early days of the railway. And because that's another thing as well, is that my railway has actually had gravity workings, which was something that the Breckenthorst tramway never had, but it was something, like, there was a book about it, a book long out of print, described it in massive detail, or as much detail as they could found. It was, I can't remember what it's called Breckenthorst tramway, an archaeology of an early railway system, and it said in that how, you know, if they had gravity workings, it probably would make the line more efficient. I thought, what if it had converted to a narrow, what if, rather than the original plateway line being, say, 3 foot, what if it was something like 2 foot 3 inches and was engineered on a constant grade like the Stiniog to obviously, you know, go down from the quarries, limestone quarries at Penwilt, which is the high point of the line, to Usladare, to Ustergunlice and Usladare, where generally the wards are. So, yeah, so I basically made a dandy wagon, and, yeah, it was a really fun little... You know, it was one of those builds where it was so quick that I just enjoyed it because it was like the moment, the energy, the adrenaline. And it's kind of good in a way because it kind of shows sort of an earlier part of a railway system. And that's another thing I try to do with models is I like to build models to show like essentially like an entire history of the railway up to the date that my layout, future layout is setting, which is going to be about 1927. And this is another thing that Ted Tholett has. Like, he has stock from, like, when the earlier part of the Craig Carr and Dunlop Stair right up to the more modern one. So, you know, I like to take inspirations from a lot of people in a way. And, you know, what I'm doing is nothing new, but I like to adapt it and sort of give my own twist on it.
Brilliant. And, of course, the dart castings horse adds a nice bit of ballast to the wagon.
It does, yeah, although it is quite... let's just say it has a very high centre of gravity, which doesn't... Which, yeah, I mean, it's one of those... It doesn't, like, run terribly well, but, you know, it's an interesting little wagon. And then, about a year or so later, I did another bash, which is in a style of an old plateway vehicle, because I think it was last year I got really interested in sort of the very early railways from, you know, the early 19th century, and I thought, oh, it would be good to model one of those. And so I had another Dapple rocket tender, and so I just bashed that, really. And so, and in a way, and it's just to represent like some of the earlier sort of wagons on the railway system, I was inspired by many prototypes of plateway wagons, including one, I can't remember who it was on Stratford somewhere, I don't know, but Stratford-upon-Avon, I don't know, but yeah, it was a, I just like things that interest me, and if it's something really interests me, I like to build it.
What do you think about the new sort of injection of ready-to-run models into 009? And are there any that you're excited about?
Well, believe me, if it weren't for RTR models, I probably wouldn't even got into 009. I mean, I do feel like RTR models in 009 is a good thing. It's finally that manufacturers are starting to sort of take note of the scale. And I've got a few ready-to-run models myself. Like, I've got a few Pico vehicles. I've got the Backland Lording, which is lovely. And I suppose there's those that argue that it does sort of cheapen and diminish the value of the hobby, especially with 009, with being it being such a sort of kit-built and scratch-built and bodging sort of hobby that, like, in a way, 00 was back about 50...
Well, yeah, but, you know, it doesn't suit everyone, does it?
No.
You know, the idea of, you know, cobbling together three sort of bits of motors and things that you've found from some derelict electrical equipment to try to make it run, it may suit some people, may not others. But, yeah, you know, again, it comes back to it. At the end, you've got some people, all they want to do is run trains, and so they just buy a load of ready-to-run stuff, and they run trains. That's what they enjoy. Other people then, perhaps more like towards Dan's spectrum, like to actually take a kit, build it, completely embellish it and turn it into something that they want. It's two very different approaches, isn't it?
Or even take an RTR item and modify it again. Like my first van that I've ever bought that got me essentially into 009 rear modelling, I still have. I've rewheeled it with some nice metal wheels and added it and turned it into essentially a luggage van to go with some of my coaches.
That's great. So for you, the ready-to-run stuff was your doorway into creating your own 009 network.
Yeah, and I suppose to RTR models that I'm looking forward to, well, thing is, I'm kind of at the stage now where pretty much most of the stock pretty much sorted. Like the fleet would have been consist of about 12 engines, and so I've basically got all 12 now, so I just got to build it all.
It's just getting around to it, that's the problem.
Yeah, it's just the time, isn't it?
What I find is that I think I'm done, and I don't need any more, and then someone announces something, and I'll go, oh, maybe I could find an excuse for that. Yeah. Maybe I could find a reason for that.
I suppose RTR models that I very much, you know, really sort of like and looking forward to, well, I'm looking to see how the Backland Hunsets turn out. Quarians, I think they'll be really popular. Like, I could see them selling like hotcakes.
Mm.
But I suppose if I had a wish list for a 009 model, I would love to buy the WD Hunslet 460s. Because I feel like that, personally, Backland should have announced a model of them rather than a Hunslet to go with the WD range and to complement the Baldwin. Because I've got to say, like, I saw it on action at the Stiniog past, present, and future event last week, and I just loved it. Like, you know, I would have had that over the Baldwin. That's just, you know, the only thing you can get of that, really. If you want to make a model in 009, you've got to buy a kit from Langley, which uses an old Minitrix chassis, which is long been not manufactured.
Mm.
But I do think RTR is a really important step for the 009 and really might make it onto mainstream, but I kind of hope that there'll always be people like myself who just want something a little different and go the extra mile.
Absolutely.
Anyway, yeah, I think modelers you should definitely check out. Obviously, Ted Polet is one. Another one is Charles Inslee, a university lecturer. You know, he's been one of my biggest inspirations as well. And, you know, he's a great guy. And another one I say is pretty much one of my absolutes there is James Hilton. He's also an illustrator, and he does brilliant models and kits the Now Planet. Seriously, he is such a talented guy. And finally, and this is like one person that I think there has been a bit of inspiration in a way, is Dad.
Oh, thank you.
You weren't expecting that.
You know, just the fact that he got me into the hobby and, you know, how he still supports me and all.
Here we are. Aww.
Yeah.
That's sweet. Well, thanks, guys. Thanks so much for coming on Railway Mania.
Yeah.
It's been great having you.
Very much.
And we hope to see more from you in the future.
Thank you very much for having me on Railway Mania, Corwin. It really has been an honour.
Thanks again, guys. Cheers. Many thanks to Daniel and Mike for coming on the show and for taking time out of their holiday for me to interview them. If you would like to see more of Daniel's work, check out his Instagram. The username is d_j_thomas517. I'm now back with Pat James. Pat, I don't think you own a single ready-to-run locomotive. Most of your stock has been kit or scratch-built. What was your progression arc? So I believe you started with a Pico tram loco kit. Where did it go from there?
So starting off in white metal, I think, is the obvious starting point. I suppose when I first got into it, either I didn't know of 3D printing or it hadn't quite kicked off yet. For sort of narrow gauge pre-printed bodies, they weren't really a thing, I think, at that very moment. So I went straight into the white metal stuff. I got a few of the 579 kits. I think a lot of people that have built them realise that they're not the best quality kits, but as a scratch aid, they can be good. And I suppose that's what I do and still enjoy doing, because it gives you a lot. It gives you a good starting point to build something good, but it's not always the best option. I think working in brass is good, and it's certainly a process that I'm still no master at. I'm still learning a lot all the time, but that would be where I'm working to, I suppose.
Presumably that means then manufacturing your own parts to go with that kit in order to complete it. And what kind of materials would you be looking at using for that?
Mostly styrene. In fact, to be honest, I've done a lot of building in plastic. It's not the best thing to build in.
Why is that?
It's just not as rigid. And you can make it rigid, but for bodies, it's okay. You can pass it off as all right, and it can be used. But I'd probably preferably use brass where I can. But yeah, manufacturing parts would be, you know, small bits of metal, brass, and styrene, really, to be honest. Depending what I've got in the box, really. I make use of as much as I can.
Mm.
There are parts you can buy. RT Models do a lot of stuff, and Narrow Planet.
And at what stage would you say you were at, and what made you make the leap into brass? Because I think a lot of people are almost scared of starting in brass because it's quite daunting, and everybody who does work in brass says they don't want to work in anything else.
Yeah, well, basically, I realised quite early on after building a couple of 579 kits that there just wasn't the prototypical accuracy that I was trying to achieve, mainly down to the chassis, I suppose. So I discovered backwards miniatures, and unfortunately, very sadly, you know, they're not training at the moment. You know, whether they will in the future, we don't know, but I discovered their kits and I bought one, and it blew my head off when I opened the box. I didn't know what I'd got myself in for.
What was it?
I bought the Canopus, which is the Manning Mordell 062, which was on the Pentuan clay line in Cornwall. So I bought that, you know, with the original idea that I'd build a Cornish sort of style layout. And I built it, and I used glue to glue it all together, and it was awful. And I've recently rebuilt the majority of it. But I sort of started to understand what the kits were about. And then I followed that up by getting the RT Model Peckett, the Gasworks one, the Harrogate Gasworks Peckett. So I got that, which is kind of half white metal, half brass. And I built that, and I used glue. And again, I've gone back and I've redone a lot of what I did. And that came out really well. And I actually put the chassis in and I got it running, chipped it for DCC. And that's when I thought, right, okay, cool, I've got this. I know how to do this. So as a stepping stone, that engine was amazing.
And RT Models get quite a good reputation, and they're quite well deserved.
Oh,
I think.
Brilliant. Yeah.
They've always been good.
Yeah.
For any time I need parts, they've always got it.
That was one of the best kits I've ever built. It went together beautifully, even when I pulled it apart. You know, it cleaned up beautifully and sold it back really nicely. Yeah, I can't fault them. And yeah, I think it's Robert Thompson. It's brilliant. And recently he's released some more stuff as well, which is immediately I pounced all over, because there were parts that I was either looking to manufacture myself or waiting for someone to make. So I jumped on that immediately. If I can't make it, a lot of the time I'll buy his parts and I'll sort of kit bash it up and pull it apart and refunction it.
Scratch aid. So for the uninitiated, can you just run us through what you call a scratch aid? What is that?
So it's either a 3D printed or white metal kit that I would possibly take away some of the detail that comes with the kit and take it down to the bare body, mainly using the smoke box, the boiler, possibly the tanks, sometimes the cab as well. But in lots of cases, I would remove the roof, the chimney and odd bits and bobs. Certainly if it was 3D printed, and then source my own or make my own. I find that sometimes if you were to just buy a 3D printed body or a white metal body and build it, paint it, you lose a lot of the detail.
in that process. It's not strong enough, and it will never translate to either a picture, really. You'd have to see it in the flesh for you to sort of get all the detail, which is fine. But, you know, preferably I'd strip it back and then add in all my own detail. Lots of stuff would be overscale if it's been printed or cast. So in lots of cases, it's good to sort of get rid of it and then replace it with brass wire, perhaps, because you can get a finer gauge on parts. And then there's lots of parts that will be cast into it, like the smoke box dart will be cast flush against the smoke box door, where I'd always file that off and then source a proper dart and put that in. Yeah, a lot of the time I might take rivets off and use rivet transfers. Lots of people don't get on with them, but
an acquired taste.
Yeah, they are. Yeah, those sorts of transfers aren't my fondest job, I'm not going to lie, but it's part of the process. It's the same as transferring lining on. I hate doing it, but if you don't do it, it always seems as if it's missing something, so I always add that in. Yeah, adding always work plates, always either file that off if it's cast, and then add in my own, maybe even a nameplate.
So depending on your skill level, you could either leave all this stuff on, but if you want to go for something a bit more fine scale, then you've got the ability to just rip it all apart. So you're using it as the bare bones, really, of what you want.
Yeah, of course, yeah.
Yeah.
I think the hardest thing for modelling in 009 and similar narrow gauge style modelling is sourcing chassis, really, especially if they're prototypical. There's many different ways you can go about it. It can be very expensive. Sometimes I'd be looking at starting off a scratch build based on a chassis that cost you 140 quid. I don't ever spend that sort of money on them, but it can be an expensive process. So I might look for a chassis for a year just to get it, you know, maybe catch it on eBay cheap, sometimes not working, and I have to then try and, you know, repair this locomotive just to get this expensive engine that I can pull apart and rebuild as to something I want. Yeah, it's part of the process, part of the hobby, isn't it?
It is
an expensive hobby, and 009 isn't an exception to that.
It is an expensive hobby, but then again, if you were paying somebody else to do the kind of work that you're doing, it would be an even more expensive hobby.
Yeah, definitely. But then, you know, I think the ready to run thing was way overdue for 009, and I'm so glad it is here, although I haven't delved into it yet. There are certain engines that are lined up for release that I can't wait to come out because I plan to buy them and pull them apart. But then again, there's some fantastic engines out there that, you know, I'm keen to eventually get myself, but building them myself and modifying them somehow is just what I enjoy doing.
We've done a lot about why narrow gauge and the challenges that narrow gauge modders face. We've talked a lot about how it actually breeds creativity. You're developing a narrow gauge empire at the moment, really. And where did that inspiration come from?
I think when I originally got into 009, I was looking on the internet at some of the other fantastic layouts that people have produced over the years, and Craig Corrigan, Dun Alistair Railway by, is it Ted Pellett, that's it. I think he's from the Netherlands. His layout is fantastic, and it blew my mind, and I know that you've got an appreciation for that as well.
Mm-hmm.
But I suppose it's the freedom that you get in 009. You know, you can create your own railway companies, you can build your own locomotives, you can almost build them to your own designs or a freelance design of another, you know, company. And I suppose that was a big one for me. And then sort of delved into the gauge a bit further, I came across County Gate by John de Frazenet, and that blew my mind, really, the sort of the level that he was willing to go to with the modelling and the mechanisms and the sort of working the kits, which is really what I've taken a lot of my influence from.
I think a whole generation of narrow gauge models have actually been influenced by John County Gate and Cliffhanger as well, which was just stunning as an exhibition layout.
Amazing, yeah. And from, you know, the locos to the sort of topography of the actual railway itself, the sort of slash in the track tricks, you know, he almost, not mainly sort of made the rules, but he certainly wrote part of that rule book, I think. You know, there's some other fantastic ones out there, especially some of the ones that the groups do. But yeah, I really, really took a lot of influence from County Gate. And obviously he answered and fixed a few of the problems that people were having, either using others' methods or developing them himself.
So County Gate really represents a might have been empire of what the Linton Barnstable could have expanded into in this fictional world. Are you taking that concept and developing that into a Cornish version?
Yeah, I suppose I am actually, yeah. And instead of being the southern, it's more Great Western. But also looking at the Welsh pool and how that got soaked up by the Great Western, and certainly the Vale of Rheidol. I really like how the logos looked after they had their Great Western liveries on them.
Well, they were rebuilt by Swindon.
Also rebuilt at Swindon as well.
Rebuilt, I'm putting air quotes around rebuilt.
Yeah.
They're new. They were new.
Yeah, yeah. You know, and that's a huge element of to sort of the idea of my layout.
Pat, someone wants to get into 009. They've got their ready-to-run stuff already, but they want to push things further. What do you think they need as a basic starter set?
Well, some of the greater modellers would have workshop equipment. I don't actually use any of that. I don't think it's necessary to have pillar drills and different types of coping saws and stuff. But it's just basic hand tools, really, and then support that with the Dremel. That's all I really use. A good set of files, sharp blades for a Stanley knife.
That's actually one of the most important ones, I think.
Oh,
I mean, the amount of times I've been frustrated, and the reason was I hadn't changed the blade in the knife.
Definitely.
Why can't I cut through this?
Or you can't cut a straight line. A good metal rule is a good one to have.
And what about materials? What kind of material should they shop for if they want to start scratch building or augmenting a kit or modifying a ready to run?
I'd certainly recommend starting out in styrene before moving on to brass, mainly because it's cheaper. It's easier to glue it rather than having to work with a soldering iron. And you can kind of cut and recut, reshape and file a lot easier just to get all the angles correct. And then you can always add ballast and weight later on. I'd always use lead shot for that, the small lead balls, because you can just pour them into a section of, you know, a tank or whatever, or a bunker, and then you can just fill it with glue. Not PVA.
No, because it explodes.
Yeah.
Slowly, over time. Yeah.
Didn't know that.
Yeah, don't use PVA. Oh, and
lucky
together.
I don't, yeah.
Yeah. There's been quite a lot of horrible incidents where people's models have kind of slowly expanded and been kind of blown apart in slow motion over the course of months because the lead and the PVA react together. So try and use cyanoacrylate for gluing in lead.
Yeah, I didn't know that. You know, I just use, to be honest with you, I use Pound Shop Super Glue and I buy it by the packet load. And I go through it like it was water, really.
And it is quite like water because it does get everywhere if you're not careful.
Yeah, it does, yeah. And it's not the best, but it does do. It holds. I find it holds fine. You know, you could use more upmarket glue, and I'm sure it would be a bit more superior than the cheap glue I use, but it does me fine. And it's easy to file off as well and sand off if you need to.
Styrene's quite a forgiving material.
It is, yeah. But I find that you have to use, what I use is I use dry, wet and dry. Once I've built the main structure, to sand off any of the scratches you get from the files. So files are good to use to sort of clean up and smooth up the corners quite quickly, but then you just want to quickly rub over it with a bit of wet and dry paper just to get a clean, smooth surface. Because once you start coating it in spray paint, you'll pick up those scratches.
Yeah, and it'll show through every surface.
Yeah, yeah. Obviously, Milliput is the big one, really. I use that a lot. Yeah, two-part milliput resin, epoxy resin. Get some sort of filling resins as well, just for filling small gaps.
Well, like what kind of brands would you recommend?
Humbrol is probably... This is the brand I use mostly. Games Workshop, I think, do something called Green Stuff, which is quite good for moulding parts. I think a lot of people do use that, or filling gaps when needed. If you choose to model in white metal, I'd highly recommend something to fill the gaps, i.e. Green Stuff or Milliput.
Is that because white metal can get dented and scratched?
Sometimes, yes, that. And also, they're not always square. It might be the moulded sort of castings that are glued or soldered together, but they won't always be true. I always find that you have to fill the gaps and sometimes twist them very slightly to get them to sit fine. And I know that's probably a bit of an amateur way of doing it, but the castings aren't perfect.
That's certainly my experience with them, is that I had to do quite a lot of filing and shaping to actually get them to sit square on each other.
They can be pigs, yeah, they really can. Certainly if you're trying to find space for decoders and stuff and you've got to cut through tons of white metal to try and sort of, you know, mill it out so you can find some space, that could be hard work as well.
Recently, over the last few years, we've gone from having basically nothing available in British 009 narrow gauge models to having quite a lot on the market. And I think this is almost spearheaded by Backman taking a punt. They released a Scarlowy that was affordable and with a simple narrow planet kit could be adapted into quite a workable model of Talith Lyn.
Yeah, well, I think it was a good start as well. Obviously being Talith Lyn. And obviously Narrow Planet backing it up with the conversion kit was really, really good. And yeah, and since then they've kind of, you know, it started to set a standard with 009. Yeah, they run well, and then they've backed that up with a load of line side buildings as well.
It's making 009 as accessible as 00.
Yeah. You know, it does come at a premium price, but you're getting good running, accurate models.
Less so Scarlowy, more thinking about the sort of upcoming Baldwin that's recently been released.
It looks like a fantastic model, yeah, really, yeah. Really good. And lots of good different liveries. The Southern livery they did for it looks fantastic.
Talking about the Southern, we also saw Hellion coming out with their Linton Basketball Looker, which was a mixed bag, really.
Yeah, they had a bit of a hiccup with the first batch, which is understandable, I think, with the Joy Valve gear.
It's a nightmare in real life. Never mind doing a model of it.
Yeah, and then manufacturing that, mass producing it, it must have been a nightmare. And yeah, there was mixed reviews on the first batch, but actually now they seem to have sorted that problem out, and you know they're working on lots more models. And yeah, we're looking forward to the Baldwin coming out as well. Lyn
should hopefully. Well, I think someone mentioned that the Linton and Bartsville Railway might be the first railway where all of its locos and stock can be bought and ready to run.
Yeah, that's amazing. That is amazing.
I mean, from nothing just 10 years ago.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, I own one of the backwards kits and it's fantastic, but I also own one of the chassis from the ready to run one that I managed to get hold of on eBay.
Yes.
It was fantastic engineering.
You told me how you got hold of that, and it's because someone managed to super glue it to their desk.
Yeah.
So you were just in the right place at the right time.
Yeah.
But I think as well, we're going to see with these ready-to-run ones, once they become a bit cheaper and a bit more readily available and they get more play-worn, some of them will get trashed, we'll be able to use those as donors for stuff we want to model.
Oh, there's some fantastic models due to come out that I can't wait, because the mechanisms that will be in them will be fantastic for other projects. And as you said, as they get played with and more worn and they come up on, you know, second-hand, be a bit more accessible for people that are willing to break them down and build them into other things.
Almost grisly that we're looking forward to things that we can chop apart.
Oh, that's it, yeah, that's it.
With the amount of RTR stuff being produced now, I think that we're going to see more and more 009 layouts, which can only be a good thing.
Yeah, I totally agree. And, you know, younger people getting into 009 as well.
It becomes more affordable.
Exactly.
And your skill level, the entrance exam, comes down quite a lot.
Yeah.
I think that makes it more accessible. Like we said earlier, you can buy a Scarlowy from Backman,
yeah,
or from, you know, a secondhand seller, and you can pull the face off and you can, you know, change all the details on it and make it either one of your own models or, you know, one of the realistic Talkins or different Scarlowys. You know, you can make all sorts of variants. I've seen people make ones that are accurate, including the cabless version.
Yeah.
As an 040.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
They're incredibly...
Yeah, it's fantastic. And it's really good that they're doing it. I support it 100%. You know, and going into the more expensive race to run, your 4D, I've started doing their lines of the trams from Glyn Valley. They've produced Russell and some other locomotives as well.
Yeah, yeah, and they're making use of emerging technologies as well.
Yeah.
To enable them to do that, 3D printing and stuff. And I think... with 3D printing especially, we're going to see improving results from that, because I know a lot of people have problems with layering and visible layering coming through on locos, and I think you can get rid of that with a lot of prep work, but obviously that's a lot of time.
Yep.
But I kind of feel like that can only get better.
Yes. I hope so. I really do. I think their locos are fantastic, but you do see some print lines in them, you know, and at those sort of premium prices you would expect to not But like you said, fantastic technology.
All in, we can say the future looks bright for 009.
Yeah, the cottage industry's always been really strong. Although sometimes there are gaps in supply, it survived on cottage industries. So
I think one of the challenges as well with ready-to-run manufacturers, and one of the things that might have put them off, is that every single narrow gauge railway is different. Apart from if you take out the contractors' railways and things like that, like Quarry Hunslers did not turn up in, you know, Cornwall until the Longston turned up. But okay, bad example. Let's say Linton and Barnstable Manning Wardles did not turn up in Scotland.
No.
And it's quite hard for manufacturers to do stuff that appeals to many people, but I think a lot of people use their imaginations and either make fictionalized versions of it or invent a reason, or invoke rule one, which means I can do whatever the heck I want, and it looks pretty.
Yeah, I think that's possibly the main reason that I was attracted to 009. It's not having been tied to railway companies and tied to the rules and regulations that people might set out. And if you do want to follow this hobby to exhibition, then those are kind of the rules that you end up abiding to. And 009, that rule book is, well, almost non-existent.
There's a lot more creativity, I feel.
Yeah, and it's, I think it's something that standard gauge by yourself modelling lacks, really.
But I think it's also down to availability. Like, I honestly think we're going to see so many Linton Barnstable railway layouts. You get the stock, you can buy all the bits and pieces, you can buy the buildings, you can plonk it down, here's a Linton Barnstable station. And there's nothing wrong with that at all. But I think the challenge is then going to be trying to do something original around that. And I think that has always been the challenge. And I think that's what is, like yourself, has enticed lots of people into this specific branch of the hobby.
Yeah, well, the Glynn Valley locomotives turned up on everything, didn't they?
Oh, yeah.
For many years.
They got everywhere. Despite being a different gauge to absolutely everything else, they turned up in every part of the world. It's also everybody's first radio control one, because you can hide all the gubbins inside it.
You can indeed, yeah.
Pat, thanks very much for coming on Railway Mania.
You're welcome.
Hope to have you back again soon.
Thank you very much for having me.
Folks, I'm afraid I have some incredibly sad and upsetting news. In February 2020... Pat went in for a second operation on the brain tumour he mentioned in episode 3. There were complications with the operation, and I'm so sorry to say that Pat has passed away. I'm devastated. Pat was one of those people who you could talk to for 10 minutes and it felt like you'd known him ages. He was so encouraging of the podcast and was one of the reliable people I would send test edits to give me honest feedback. He was one of the most talented modellers I've ever known, someone who could turn their hand to anything. The things he created by scratch building and experimentation, I could only dream of doing. Pat was also kind enough to come on the podcast as my first guest, and many people have said what a natural he was at it. I've set up a page on the website dedicated to Pat's modelling. If you go to railwaymania.net and click on the link in the top menu, it'll take you there. You can also see his work on his Instagram account. His name is pats.ng.work_bench. I want to dedicate this podcast to my friend Pat, who I will miss so much.